rising now from what more than ever had become a water-meadow wilderness against the big southern sky which I loved looking at, there was the damaged, the mutilated aspen fan, with the jagged, torn stumps of the two side aspens clearly showing. It would be 15 or 20 years before aspen greenery such as I had known would again shade and give scale to the view. Mrs. Phillips said, "I thought I should let you know." This was her nurse's manner, which she shared with Mr. Phillips and perhaps to some extent copied from him. The other side of this manner, with Mr. Phillips, was his authority, his power, his irritability. With Mrs. Phillips it was her invalid's manner, the thin, dark skin darkening and gathering below her eyes, the thin veins getting blue and prominent, seeming about to rupture, suggesting with the very many fussy, shallow lines on her forehead infinite suffering and fragility. She said, "I thought I should let you know. I know you're close to him. They're letting Mr. Pitten go." The Mister was for my sake. That was how I called him and referred to him. She and Mr. Phillips called him Fred. "Of course," she said, a little more jauntily, "it's been coming for some time." And that was true, though I had never wanted to face the facts, or to inquire too carefully into them, half wishing to believe in magic, in things going on as I had found them, believing, like Alan, to some extent, in the great wealth of my landlord and the ability of the people who looked after his affairs to perform great financial feats. But I knew that Pitten and his house were costing money, and the Phillipses were costing money, and the manor itself was very expensive to maintain even in the way it was, and I could see that the estate, more a nature reserve than workable land, provided little revenue. The great inflation of the mid-70s would have cut cruelly into whatever income my landlord had, and the manor required too much attention. It wasn't a place that could simply be let go. It wasn't like my cottage. Its scale was more than human. It exaggerated human needs. People had to be trained to use buildings like the manor, and that was why, like the ancient Roman villa at Chedworth in Gloucestershire, these buildings were perishable. People could easily do without them. When the boiler exploded at the manor, and the ceramic or concrete or asbestos casing of the tall metal chimney against one wall had shattered into 1,000 jagged fragments all over the manor courtyard, I heard, either from the Phillipses or from Michael Allen, the young central heating man who came with his van and spent many days in the courtyard, that the annual heating costs at the manor were £4,000 to £5,000. That might have been an exaggeration. Men like Michael Allen, entering rich houses for the first time because of their skills and trades, might have liked to exaggerate the importance of their county or gentry clients. Still, £5,000 as a heating bill, it showed how unstable prices and our world had become. In 1857, in Madame Bovary, Flaubert could write of the peddler's 6% interest charge as extortionate, bloodletting. Now we lived easily with that kind of charge. In 1955, when I was very young and new to London and trying to write, I wanted nothing more than £500 a year, and, more modest than Virginia Woolf 30 years before, I would have undertaken to pay for my own rented room out of those £500. In 1962, at a lunch in a London club, with a humorous writer and a cartoonist, I put my needs, the two other men had asked, at £2,000 a year. I had moved up from the rented room to the rented, self-contained flat. This figure had scandalized my fellow lunchers, older men, as far too low. And indeed, just 3 years later, when I had bought a house and taken on a mortgage, I would have considered £5,000 a year as just about fair. Now that was a figure that could be talked about as a heating charge. Not many fortunes would have been able to stand that kind of expense, one among many. And my landlord had retired from the world in 1949 or 1950. Some years before I had thought £500 a year enough for my needs. I watched for Pitten. He had the knack. Sometimes it seemed, in spite of the steadiness and gravity of his movements, like a little game he played with himself, of reaching the white gate at the end of the lawn more or less on the stroke of 1 o'clock. He would appear on the lawn in front of my cottage, his morning's work done, 4 or 5 minutes before the hour. He would do what he had to do in the garden shed, put away tools, reassume formal clothes, if that was necessary, for the short walk along the public road to his house, lock up the shed, and then, adjusting his pace to the time in hand, start on the walk to the gate. Sometimes he would enter the lawn from the vegetable garden through an old wooden gate, overspecified, pulled out of true now by its own sturdiness and weight, in the garden wall. Sometimes, coming out of the summer bush, as clean as a cat, he walked up from the overgrown orchard through the overgrown box-hedged enclosure. This morning he came out of the box-hedged enclosure. He had only in the last week cut his first summer path through the tall weeds there, one swath up, one swath down. He was not wearing his plastic raincoat or his Wellingtons. He was quite formally dressed, without a jacket, but with a country shirt and his woolen tie. He didn't have to change. What he had to do in the garden shed didn't take long. His walk to the gate was his very slow, arm-dangling walk, not the way he walked when he pushed open the gate at 9 in the morning, not the way he walked when he worked. This very slow walk was the way Pitten walked when his work was over, when his time had become his own again, and there was nothing in his walk now that hinted at the end of a routine, nothing in his pre-lunch ritual that suggested an agitated man. A man in possession of the news Mrs. Phillips had given me half an hour before. At 2 o'clock he was back. He unlatched the white gate that separated the short, dark, yew-hung lane from the open manor lawn, latched it behind him, and his walk, though unhurried, suggested a man who was at work again. I thought that there had been a mistake, that Mrs. Phillips had misheard, or it passed on to me as a decision, something that had been only an idea, something that had perhaps been discussed and dropped. Pitten was so untroubled. I thought he knew better than Mrs. Phillips. An hour and a half later, after my walk on the downs past Jack's cottage up between the barrows to the view of Stonehenge, an hour and a half later, coming back to the grounds, I heard the shout of, "Fred!" from Mr. Phillips, shouting to Pitten from the manor, shouting to Pitten somewhere in the back garden. There was no reply. This was normal. And then at 5 there was a ritual of Pitten's departure, locking up the garden shed and expressing in his very slow walk to the front gate the end of the day's labours. But he didn't appear at the gate at 9 the next morning. He didn't appear at 9:30 or at 10. It was later, in the middle of the morning, just before 11, that I saw him. And he was banging imperiously at my kitchen door, the only door I used, the door that faced the abandoned cold frames, the heavy timber-framed glass covers stacked up against a high garden wall, the nettles growing tall behind and between the glass, and over the wall, some distance away, near the river willows, the tall middle aspen and the mangled but already sprouting stumps of the other two. The foolish pride he had displayed when I had seen him in his house— and complimented him on his hi-fi equipment, the pretense that he had a rich source of money quite separate from his gardener's wages, the passion, the staring, enlarged eyes, the quivering nostrils on the pink champagne morning when he had stood awkwardly bent, the tie dangling from his neck in front of the overgrown box trees, and waited for me to come to him. All of that, the folly, the pride, the wildness, the passion, was in his face. But instead of the surprise of champagne, there was the bewilderment of anger, an anger that seemed to have taken him to a depth of feeling for which he was not prepared, anger that seemed to have taken him close to madness. He said, "You heard? You heard?" He was wearing no tie, the shirt of the day before, but no tie. I saw him without a tie only on Sundays, sometimes, in the summer, when the ice cream van passed before lunch and tinkled its chimes, and we both went out to buy ice cream. He wanted someone to witness and share his outrage. He could not bear to be with himself. But he had no gift of words, had never had. All the passion came out in his face. It was like the champagne surprise, but twisted and taken several notches higher, and in his abrupt movements. I opened the door wide for him to come inside, but he, as though recognizing that he had nothing more to say, stayed outside. Abruptly he turned away and walked fast and jerkily, as though with some sudden clear purpose, down the lane between my cottage and the yew hedge and the forester's hut on one side and the half-cottage against the garden wall on the other side, the half-cottage in which I stored coal and wood and other things. A little way beyond this half-cottage, and how well, from using the lawnmower in that neglected corner, I knew the uneven ground, partly built up from wood ash and knew the tufts of rough grass, there was the tall gate in the vegetable garden wall. This was Pitten's gate. It was chained and padlocked every evening, and Pitten had the key. The gate, as old as the manor, had a heavy timber frame, with solid boards in its lower half and vertical iron bars in its upper half. It had been pulled out of true by its own weight and sturdiness. Whenever Pitten opened the gate, he had to lift it slightly, and the part of the vertical iron bar which he had held in this strong, lifting way 4 or 5 or 6 times a working day was smoother and much darker than the rest of the iron, which was rusted and rough and dry. To this gate Pitten went, walking fast, jerkily, his own gate, opening into his own territory. But he didn't have the key. That was in the garden shed. He crossed the lawn in his new, hurried way to the garden shed built onto the side of the farmhouse. Beside the green-painted, faded door there was an old climbing rose. Pitten pruned it each year. It produced only a few roses, but they were all big, cabbagey things, pale pink. Pitten had the key to the garden shed on him. It was attached to a chain. The chain was fixed to a loop in his waistband. He pushed the green door open. The shed was dark inside. He forgot about the key to the garden gate. He left the shed door wide open and walked across the lawn, that part which still bore the impression, like ghostly shadows of the 3 felled beeches, to the openness of the manor courtyard. The wide-open door of the garden shed, left just like that, was unlike Pitten. A while later he walked past my cottage again, to the heavy gate in the garden wall, forgetting again that he didn't have the key to the padlock, that he had gone for it to the garden shed and got distracted. He was disorientated, his frenzy expressed in these brisk, jerky little journeys, half yielding to his old routine, his wish to look after his garden, to do the jobs he had planned to do that morning, and then awaking afresh to his loss. Like an ant whose nest had just been smashed, he moved about hither and thither. At some stage he closed the door of the garden shed, and then he went away. But not by the white gate. At lunchtime Mrs. Phillips came to see me. She had a reproving, hospital manner. She said, as though speaking to one patient about another who had behaved badly, "Your Mr. Pitten was quite another person this morning. He came and sounded off about everything under the sun, accusing us of everything he could think of, as though we had anything to do with anything. He knew very well what was going to happen. He knew everything yesterday. I don't know why he pretended not to know. It was just pretense, you know. He didn't say a thing, not in the morning, not at lunchtime, not when he had his tea with us. That was typical Pitten." She spoke as though Pitten's refusal the previous day to acknowledge his notice or his news, when she would have been waiting for his reaction, was wicked and deserved the punishment it got. She spoke as though this wickedness of Pitten's made everything explicable, absolved us all of the need to feel concerned for Pitten and frightened for ourselves. And it was strange, Pitten's silence of the previous day. Had he not understood? Had he not taken in what had been said to him? Had he simply not listened? Had the words of the man in the grey suit been roundabout? Had the news been too shocking for Pitten to believe it? Or was it his own form of magic? I remembered how, when Jack had fallen ill and his garden had grown wild, and the chimney was smoking in the summer, and Jack was in his bedroom trying to get warm, trying to unfreeze the blocks of ice that his lungs must have felt like, I remembered how Jack's wife had denied that anything was wrong with the garden. And her manner had even suggested that I had said something discourteous and wrong. So, quite suddenly, from one day to the next, part of the routine of the manner I had grown into, part of my new life and comfort, my private, living book of hours, was snapped. I never saw Pitten unlatching the wide, white gate at the end of the lawn at 9 again, or walking back to it at 1 and then at 5. With a special, slow step of a man who had done his morning's and then his day's labour. Were there personal things he'd left behind in the garden shed? Wellingtons, a plastic raincoat, a jacket? Did he come back for these things later, or did he abandon them with the garden shed key? The key he had carried in that intimate way on a chain that ran from a loop in his waistband to his right trouser pocket. That key he had to give up to Mr. Phillips. And thereafter, at odd hours, the washed-out, green-painted garden shed door, beside the thick-stalked rose bush, now almost a small tree that Pitten had pruned year by year, thereafter, for long periods during the day, that door remained open. Pitten's shed exposed. Pitten's territory no longer Pitten's. Neither shed, nor key, nor tools, nor the heavy, tilting gate to the vegetable garden. That open garden shed door, which Pitten had been so particular to keep closed, I could see it from the window of my room, and it was unsettling. I wished to close it. It was like the wish to straighten a mirror, or picture hanging crooked on a wall. That open door, together with other changes, it was as though the man concerned had died in some unsanctified way, and everything that had been his could now be treated without ceremony. When Jack, over the hill, had fallen ill, his flower and fruit garden had grown wild, and his vegetable garden, created in the waste ground between the farmyard metal dump below the beeches and the beginning of the cultivated down, had gone to seed. Pitten's vegetable garden didn't go to seed. It was tended through the summer, and its produce was gathered in. Many strangers now came to the manor grounds to do irregularly, in bits and pieces, the job that Pitten had done with unhurried system, the job around which he had built his mornings and his afternoons, his week, his year, marking the end of each stage with his own kind of ritual. This fragmentation of his job was like a further downgrading of the man, downgrading him now, and downgrading all he had done and been in the past, all his careful routine. Some of the strangers in the manor were casual workers, paid by the hour or the day, and obtained by the Phillipses from I don't know where, perhaps from the places Mr. Phillips had worked in before. Some were friends. One, who soon ceased to be a stranger, was Mr. Phillips's widowed father. He was much smaller than his son, and slighter. Physically he was of another generation, another world. One could see in him the physique of agricultural workers in old photographs. Since the death of his wife, Mr. Phillips's mother, the old man had been solitary. This opening up of the manor grounds to him, where he had been only an occasional visitor on Saturday afternoons, and the opportunity for a little light work, was a blessing to the old man. He lived much in the past, and liked to talk of the past. He was sociable. Solitude was not something he had chosen. It was like old age, something he had had to learn to live with. He had been born not far away, and had lived all his life in the county. He told me at our first meeting, just outside my kitchen door, that he had started life as a carrier's boy, the carrier for whom he worked, making a living by carrying goods and parcels for people living along the 8 miles between Amesbury and Salisbury. The old man spoke of this job, his first, as of something indescribably rich and rewarding, an enchantment. He dressed neatly in jacket and tie, like Pitten, and unlike his son, who preferred more casual and sporty clothes. And again, unlike his son, the old man wore very pale colours. It was as though the chalk of the downs by which he had been surrounded all his life had affected his taste in colours, had made him see tints where another person might have seen something neutral. The old man often came now simply to walk about the grounds, and he dressed for these walks in the manor bush as though for an urban promenade. In this he was like Pitten, in my earliest memory of Pitten. Sometimes, with the suit or the sports jacket and tie, the old man also walked with a staff, of a sort I had never seen before, shoulder high, with a prong or fork at the top in which the thumb was rested. The carrier's boy, now walking freely, privileged as the father of his son, walking with his old-fashioned staff in the overgrown grounds of a big house that was being built while he was a carrier's boy. Did the old man make the connection? The summer jobs were done. The fallen aspens, about whose wide, tangled spread of broken branches grass and weeds had grown tall and dark, a separate area of vegetation, the fallen aspens were cut up with a chainsaw and the cut logs piled up in the back garden. Grass now grew tall around the log piles, just as grass and the plants they attracted grew into a bush around the trunk fragments that were too big to cut up and stayed more or less where they had fallen, soon looking old like old debris, suggesting the further advance onto the back lawn of the water meadow wilderness. The grass of that lawn was cut. The area of the aspen fall never recovered, never returned to grass, and was abandoned to weeds and marsh growth. And the lawn in front of my cottage was cut, and the vegetable garden was looked after. This garden was hidden from my cottage by a high wall. Beyond the half-cottage that was my outbuilding, there was, set in this wall, the heavy gate with the metal bars. This gate hung unevenly, but Pitten had developed the knack of closing it. His successors didn't have this knack. The gate, unlatched, dragged more and more, and was eventually left open. Pitten's garden, the scene of his secret labours, was now quite exposed. Astonishing now, when I went in to look, astonishing as always, the different sense of space, the openness on the other side of the garden wall. The wall on that side was warm, sun-bleached. Old fruit trees had been trained and pinned against it. The wall on my side was damp, always in shadow, only summer weeds growing in the poor soil at its base. The wall that I saw from my cottage was a northern wall. The wall on the other side was Mediterranean, part of the grandeur of the original walled garden design, with its paths, its nursery beds, its vegetable areas, its formal orchard. Pitten had been able to keep only part of the garden going, but he had honoured its formality, design, and dignity. Now, after the bonanza of his vegetable garden, his successors were creating only an allotment. A cycle in the life of the manor had come to an end. There might one day be the beginning of a new cycle, but for the moment, or for some years ahead, the great walled garden, calling for the labour of many hands, had returned to a modest human scale, had become the setting for a small allotment. The wide white gate at the end of the lawn, the gate that had been Pitten's gate, was padlocked for security. And since the estates along the river were so little protected, so open, and the area now attracted many communities of dropouts and vagrants, a new tide of idleness washing back and forth over the empty spaces of southwestern England, for greater security a mass of cut branches, rapidly going brown and dry and dead, was piled up against the gate. I had replaced the idea of decay, the idea of the ideal which can be the cause of so much grief, by the idea of flux. But now, in spite of myself, the associations of the manor altered for me. I saw Pitten's hand in many places. In the refuge, in the vast leaf grave, he and I, working together on some afternoons, had gathered for compost, now no longer needed. In that open garden shed door, and in the heavy door in the garden wall that could no longer close. Yet I also knew that what had caused me delight when I first came to the manor would have caused grief to someone who had been there before me, just as what caused me grief now spoke of pure pleasure to old Mr. Phillips, with his suit and his staff, happy in the wild grounds and the small allotment. The memories of Pitten, those lingering signs of his work, work to which the man himself would now never add, were like the memories of a man who had died. And yet he was still with us, still living in his improved agricultural cottage next to Bray. It was because of that cottage, the cottage that went with his job, that he had to go. The cottage had become valuable, sturdily built, not period in the accepted way, but old enough and genuine enough in style to be interesting, and of manageable size. It was worth many thousands, 100 times the 200 or 300 pounds that Bray's father had paid for his cottage. And the estate needed the money. But Pitten didn't believe this. I met him one Saturday morning in Salisbury. He was at his most country gentleman in appearance, the suit, the shirt, the shoes, the hat, the carefully studied outfit which consumed his money. Pitten's Salisbury hat, so stylish, so elegant and gentlemanly, the gesture with which he half lifted it off his head in greeting. The imitation was now so old, the gesture so habitual, that perhaps no idea of style attached to it in Pitten's mind any longer. The face the uplifted hat revealed ran counter to the stylishness of the gesture. It was still the face of shock he had shown me when I had opened the kitchen door in answer to his imperious, angry knocking. Still that expression on his face, as though our meeting, which by chance took place in a pedestrian shopping street not far from the shop where Pitten bought his clothes, and where clothes like Pitten's could be seen in the window still, as though our meeting revived all the twisted emotions in him that could find no resolution or outlet in words. He had been told, he said, that the estate wanted his house in order to sell it. But he didn't believe that story. Who would want to buy a house next to Bray? It was an agricultural cottage, a tied cottage, something for a gardener, something that no one had particularly taken care of. And just as when I had gone to his house that Christmas time, he had suggested that he had a source of income other than his gardener's wages, so now when he spoke of the house where he had lived for 25 years and more, it was to suggest that if it had been another kind of house, he would have looked after it differently. And it was almost as if he were suggesting that his real house was somewhere else. Yet he didn't want to leave his agricultural cottage, and though many months had passed since he had stopped working at the manor, he wasn't really trying to find another job. It was as though he had begun to feel that if he didn't start looking for another job, he mightn't, after all, have to find another job. He was confused, pulled in many directions, helpless. He seemed to be proving the point made by Mrs. Phillips. She had been continuing to look for some explanation of Pitten's dismissal that would make it easier for everyone to bear, and she had settled on the idea that in his last year at the manor, Pitten had gone very strange, that he had been finally undermined by the solitude of his labour, a pretence of work, a kind of half-idling in the wilderness, and that he had gone to pieces. In her previous job, Mrs. Phillips said, she had seen any number of people who had gone to pieces. It wasn't only people you read about in the newspapers who went to pieces. I had thought that Mrs. Phillips was straining too hard to find an explanation, but then, meeting Pitten at the bus stop in the valley and meeting him sometimes in Salisbury and talking about his problems, which he kept on insisting were insoluble, I thought it was possible that Mrs. Phillips was responding to the odd mixture in his personality of passion and civility and affectation and pride and independence. He didn't want to be a gardener again, he told me. He could do the job at the manor, but he couldn't do it anywhere else, or for anybody else. It was too undignified. Nor did he want a town job. The country gentleman in him, or rather the free country labourer in him, feared the anonymity, the nothingness of the town worker. I would meet Pitten at the bus stop in the valley. We would talk then until the bus came. We never talked on the bus. We sat on different seats. We also continued to meet in Salisbury, and sometimes we met in the village on the public road when I was coming back from my walk over the downs. Our talks were circular. He would put ideas to me about what he might do. I would encourage him, and then he would reject my encouragement, returning to the idea of the grudge against him. Pitten's difficulty, as I understood when I put myself in his place and examined myself and my own fears, was that he had lost touch with the idea of work. In fact, after the manor, the freedom there, the routine he had created, the calm he had established for himself, his relationship with the seasons, the year, time itself, what he feared was not work, but employment. And perhaps not employment so much as the idea of the employer. In the end, quietly, ashamedly, he took a job. He drove a laundry van. I knew about it only when I saw him driving the van, the laundry leather money bag added to his country gentleman clothes and slung over his shoulder and chest like a bandolier. And in the end he left his cottage and was given a council flat in the town, on the old London coach road. It could not have been pleasant for him in the cottage towards the end, when he had been under pressure to leave, to release the property and the capital it represented to the estate. I expected that he would have been happy at having found another place to live, and quite a reasonable one, but with the passion and twisted emotions that had now become permanent with him, he complained. The flat was shabby. In what way? It hadn't been decorated. They expected him to do his own decorating. That was the way he was being treated. It was always hard, so convincing was Pitten's manner, to understand that he was an obedient soul, the father of an obedient soldier, that, with all his passion, Civility or dependence ran deep in his nature. Bray said, "So our friend has moved out." I was sitting beside him in his car, and he spoke out of the corner of his mouth, the corner that was on my side. Bray said, "An arrogant man." Below his driver's cap, Bray's eyes, at once concentrating on the road and expressing an inward pleasure, were like slits, sloping sharply down to the sides of his face. And then, speaking of the Manor family as though they were all still there, as though the Manor organization of which his father had formed part still existed, Bray said, "They're a funny family." There was tribute in his words, and also pride. He reached for a book on the shelf below the dashboard and passed it to me, with a semi-abstraction of a man concentrating on the road, and also with the clumsiness of a man not used to handling books. He said, mysteriously, "Have a look at this when you get home," as though the book, the mysterious object, would explain much, as though the book would free him, Bray, of the need to say more. The book was by my landlord. It was nearly 50 years old, something from the 1920s. It was a short story in verse, with many illustrations. The paper was good, the book was expensively bound in cloth, and though it carried the name of a reputable London publisher of the period, it was clear that the production of such a slight work in this lavish way had been subsidized or paid for by the author. The story was simple. A young woman gets tired of the English social round. Many opportunities there for drawings of the costumes of the 1920s. She decides to become a missionary in Africa. Goodbyes are said. The lovers who are left behind pine in different ways. A ship, the ocean, the African coast, a forest river. The young missionary is captured by Africans, natives. She has fantasies of sexual assault by the African chief to whose compound she is taken. Fantasies as well of the harem and of black eunuchs. Instead, she is cooked in a cannibal pot and eaten, and all that remains of her, all that one of her London lovers finds, is a 20s costume draped on a wooden cross, like a scarecrow. This was the joke knowledge of the world the young boy of 18 had arrived at. This was the knowledge, which would have appeared like sophistication, that had been fed by the manor and the grounds, and perhaps later knowledge had not gone beyond the joke. Outside England and Europe, a fantasy Africa, a fantasy Peru or India or Malaya. And perhaps passion, too, had never gone beyond the titillation of the Beardsley-like drawings of this book. And that was the most amazing thing about the book Bray had preserved and cherished. The drawings. They were in the very style of the drawings which Mrs. Phillips had brought over as gifts from my landlord during the previous summer, of the shopping expeditions and the champagne. He had struck his form and won admiration for his style at an early age, had early arrived at his idea of who he was, his worth and his sensibility, and he had stalled there. Perhaps he had stalled in what might be considered a state of perfection. But that perfection, that absence of restlessness and creative abrasion, that view from his back windows of a complete, untouched, untroubled world, had turned to morbidity, acedia, a death of the soul. That morbidity had been like a long sleep. Then he had miraculously awakened, and he had found his world still about him. He knew that the spaciousness of earlier days had gone, but he was prepared, as he had always been prepared, to live with what he found. That was how, projecting myself onto him, I read him. He liked ivy. When the trees in his garden collapsed, he did not complain. He had enjoyed the ivy for many years, and now he would have to content himself with other things. So it was with people. When their time came, it came. He had made no comment, from what I heard from the Phillipses, about the fall of the aspens, which he must have seen for 50 years at least. So, understanding now that there was no longer a gardener, he never, from what the Phillipses said, asked for Pitten, with whom the previous summer he had played and about whom he had made up his stories, to tell to the people remaining to him, like Alan. Like a child of 2 or 3 who might play every day with its grandmother, but then, should that grandmother suddenly die, might never ask after her. I saw Pitten driving his laundry van, sometimes. Hard to recognize in him, the man whose routine, whose appearance at the white gate, had been part of the new life and comfort and healing I had found in the valley. Sometimes we met on a Saturday in Salisbury. Once he came up behind me and called me by my name. Strange behaviour, from a buttoned-up, wordless man. But I had known him in his glory. I had helped in the grand garden of the manor, helped with the grass, the dead beech leaves. And I had called him Mr. Pitten. He grew shabbier. Fragments of his country gentleman clothes survived on him in other combinations, but his style changed. The laundryman, who did the valley round and knew Pitten, said of him, but gently and understandingly, "He's a little grumpy." But then Pitten changed. The valley laundryman, tolerant, as content with the rhythm of his weekly round, the rhythm of his year, his annual 2-week holidays, as content with the passing of time as Pitten had once been, the valley laundryman understood this change in Pitten too, and said of Pitten's improving behaviour, his lessening grumpiness, "You get used to it." There was more to it than that. Pitten, in this last decade of active life, grew out of what he had been. He got to know more people at work and on the council estate where he lived. Where he had feared anonymity, he found community and a little strength. He saw his former life as from a distance. He had always sought, in his clothes, his pride in his wife's looks, his odd poor man's pretense about the other source of income, to maintain this distance from what he was. Now there was no need. Gradually, he stopped acknowledging me from the laundry van. One day in Salisbury, in that pedestrian shopping street where he had tried to fill me with his own panic, one day he saw me. And then, the new man, he didn't see me. Rooks. Alan said, "So Pitten left. Tremendous figure of my childhood." That was Alan, the writer, the man with the childhood, the man with the sensibility. I understood this idea of the writer because it was so like my own when I had first come to England. Then I would have envied Alan the material available to him, my landlord, the manor, the setting, his deep knowledge of the setting, the London parties I occasionally saw him at. But Alan seemed to have as much trouble with his idea of the writer and his material as I had had with mine. At first he used to hint that he was at work on a book, hinting that the part of him that one saw, the part he was displaying in the manor grounds or at a London party, was just a fraction of his personality or even a disguise, that the true personality would be revealed in that book he was writing. His radio reviews and discussions, and his short printed pieces had the same suggestion, that he was fully engaged elsewhere, in some bigger venture. But no book came from Alan. No novel, or autobiographical novel, setting the record straight, showing the truth behind the shiny bright clothes and the clowning manner. No critical study of contemporary literature, which he sometimes spoke about. No Isherwood-like book about post-war Germany, which he spoke about at other times. Eventually, with me, he stopped hinting that he was writing. But he still talked like a writer, and behaved like a writer. And that writer's personality of Alan's was partly genuine, and no more fraudulent than my own character, my idea of myself as a writer, had been in 1950. Just as, in my writing in those days, I was hiding my experience from myself, hiding myself from my experience, to that extent falsifying things, yet at the same time revealing them to anyone who looked beyond the conventional words and forms and attitudes I was aiming at, so all the literary sides of his character that Alan exhibited, all the books he said he was writing, hinted at truths that were as hard for him to face as certain things had been for me. That Isherwood-like book about post-war Germany hinted at the dissatisfactions and torments of his emotional life and his involvement with a young German for whose sake he had gone to live in Germany for some time. He spoke of this attachment obliquely at the beginning, as though testing my reaction to a confession of passion from him, half a clown, as though testing my reaction to sexual inversion. Either my reaction didn't satisfy him, or he changed his mind, or his attitude to this unhappy affair altered as he began to talk about it to me, a stranger. He dropped the subject. The sketch of the young German remained unfinished, and Alan's references to Germany thereafter were straightforwardly political or cultural. And there was his autobiographical novel, the story of his childhood and the development of his sensibility. It was to be an absolute compendium of such books. His wish, as I understood too well, was to say to the world, I too have witnessed these things and felt these emotions. But below his wish to do all that had already been done, to display knowledge of all the settings, or their equivalents, that had occurred in similar books, there was something in his childhood, or upbringing, or family life, which had deeply wounded him, had committed him to solitude, uncertainty, an imperfect life. His literary approach to his experience, the self-regard that would have gone with its frankness, on approved topics, no doubt, homosexuality, masturbation, social climbing, perhaps hid the cause of his incompleteness from himself. And often in London, considering his over-skittishness at parties, his startling self-mocking dress, his nervousness in the presence of people he admired, his extravagant flattery of those persons, often in London, considering him, I felt I was considering an aspect of myself from some years back. And I had an intimation that those overbright moments of Alan's would have been followed in the solitude of his rooms or flat by self-disgust, rage, wretchedness. And I could see how the solitude of the manor, the walks in the ruined garden, would have been, in addition to its literary suitability, a kind of therapy for him. Therapy over and above his pleasure at having rich friends, because writers, as Cyril Connolly had said, should have rich friends. Over and above his pleasure at saying to me, because it was old-fashioned, before the deluge, I telephone and have Phillips meet me at the station. Not saying Mr. Phillips, or Stanley, or Stan. And there was the house itself. It had a staff, and it still worked as a big house, more or less. It offered a room and a bathroom with refurbished plumbing. It offered from the back windows, as I supposed, I hadn't seen it, a view of the garden, the river, the water meadows on both sides of the river, with the empty downs beyond. An untouched view, a view without other houses or people, a calming view. For Alan it would have been a house without any kind of strain, making no demand on him, not requiring him to act or maintain a particular personality. There was my landlord. For me it would have been a strain to be in the house with him, a strain to meet him and to note, however involuntarily, his idiosyncrasies and affectations. It would have undone the magic. But my landlord, in addition to his literary value to Alan as material, someone from an earlier age, was the one person to whom Alan stood almost in a position of authority. To my landlord, recently recovered from his acedia, Alan was still an adventurer in the titillating world from which he, my landlord, had withdrawn. My landlord was the one person to whom Alan could bring news, and yet their meetings would have been few and wouldn't have lasted long. From Mr. Phillips, I heard that my landlord tired quickly of conversation and people, social encounters, that he could suddenly become restless and dismiss even old friends. I heard, indirectly, from the Phillipses, that Alan usually ate alone in the manor. And the picture that came to my mind was not of a tray being taken to Alan's room, but of a dim ceiling bulb lighting a modest spread on an old lace tablecloth in a musty room smelling of old cedar and wood preservative. So the solitude I saw was indeed solitude. And if Alan thought it creepy that I could live in the place for so long without getting to know my landlord, I thought it strange, until I understood the particular solace the place offered him, that he should want to visit, for the reasons he gave, to be in the place important to his childhood, for the sake of the novel he was working on or planning, and also, for the sake of another book, to be in the presence of my landlord to study his speech and mannerisms, the mannerisms of a more gracious age, the age before the deluge, not the age that had finished in 1914 this time, but the age, according to Alan, that had finished in 1940, the age when houses like my landlord's were still important, not only socially, but also in the making of literary and artistic reputations. Alan suggested that in spite of his apparent idleness, his rambling about the orchard and gardens, his readiness to come to my cottage at any time, his visits to the manor were periods of work. But he was taking away volumes of notes. Sometimes he let me into the secret of the notes he was making, or had made. My landlord had said to him once, "Would you like some toast? Shall I get Phillips to bring you some toast in a chafing dish?" And Alan had roared with laughter, as much as he had roared at the story about Pitten and the pink champagne. "A chafing dish," he said. "Have you heard anybody speak of a chafing dish?" So that I felt not only that Alan, like me 25 years before in Earl's Court, had a good idea of what as a writer he expected to find, but also that my landlord, even in his shrunken world and through the darkness of his acedia, still had an idea of what was expected of him. But there was Alan's solitude, so visible in the manner, so clear in the melancholy of his knobby little face when he was caught unawares. That solitude was real enough, as real as the pain of his childhood, as real as the acedia of my landlord and the physical dereliction this acedia had created all around him. That solitude of Alan's, as he walked about the garden and grounds, was like a demonstration of the psychological damage he had suffered once upon a time. There was a part of him that hurt, a part where he could never be reached, and where he was always alone, and the nature of his education, his too literary approach to his experience, his admiration of certain writers and artists of the century, his wish to do again, but for himself, what they had done, all this conspired to conceal things from himself. The solitude of the manor grounds was a solace. Outside that was threat and the vision of his own inadequacy. He made up for this by flattery of the people he admired, and whose strength he wished he had. Like a child offering sweets to his fellows in order to buy peace, Alan told many people he was making notes about them for his big book about contemporary literature. He was keeping his eye on so many people, noting their conversation, keeping their letters. He was going to write about so many people, and it was hard, once Alan had told you he was making notes about you, to ignore him. Hard not to start acting up, even like my landlord, to an intelligent, friendly man who might indeed be making notes about all the things you were saying. He balanced this by a contempt for those writers in whom he saw versions of himself. Mimics, people doing what others had done in social chronicles and wishing to show that they could do it too. Towards these writers, whose faults he saw very clearly, he was merciless. One such writer, he was physically bigger than Alan, but was also something of a dandy in clothes, whom I saw in London, told me, "The venomous little insect came galumphing across the room at Clarissa's and said to me, 'My dear, you must stay in this Saturday and listen to the critics. I've slaughtered you. Ha ha.'" But there are not many people like that, people to whom Alan expressed open hostility. The public objects of Alan's dislike were mainly certain kinds of buildings, paintings, gardens, flowers, and here even my landlord was not exempt. My landlord liked gladioli. Pitten grew them for him in the garden. Alan hated them for their gaudiness and size. He said, closing his eyes, a shudder going right through him, "They should be that high," bending and holding his open palm down to the level of his shin. He could shudder with distaste like this when he spoke of these things, flowers, pictures, buildings, as though making up in the violence of his aesthetic responses for all the coyness he imposed on himself with other people, all the talk about notes and the writing he was preparing to do about them. "All this is going down in the diary," he would say, or personalizing it, "This is for diary," or "Diary will take due note." All the sweets he offered the world to buy peace. It was this aesthetic violence, at bottom quite genuine, reflecting a genuine sensibility, a true concern for the life of the mind, that gave his radio talks and discussions their bite and attack, and suggested that they were the merest glimpse of a fuller life and more prodigious personality. It happened sometimes that months passed without our meeting. He might not come down, or I might be away when he did come down. One day, quite unusually, he telephoned me from London, and I was aware only then that I hadn't seen him for perhaps a year or more. There were the sounds of music in the background. The music was very loud. It made me ask where he was telephoning from. It was from his flat. He said, "You talk like my neighbours. Of course I'm blasting away." and he gave his great choking laugh. The old Alan, it would have seemed. But it wasn't. He was drunk, and as he began to speak, it became clear that he was very drunk. Alcohol and music, the supports of solitude. This was new to me. Not the solitude, but the drinking. I'd never thought of Alan as a drinking man, but even drunkenness didn't alter Alan's character or show the other side of the man. Drunkenness didn't liberate him. It exaggerated, made ludicrous, his appeasing public character. Hardly able to control his words, he was seeking only to send messages of love, to flatter, to speak to me about my work. And he was asking nothing in return, for there was, as it were, no means of getting back to the person from whom all this issued. The person that wished to buy peace from the world was beyond the reach of the world, was hardly known, it might be said, to Alan himself. It didn't matter how much one flattered back, it didn't matter how much love one sent back, one could never touch the true person. Some months later he reappeared at the manor. He had greatly changed. His eyes, once so seemingly unreliable and shifty, had become dead, lackluster. There was a very old sadness there. The knobby little face had become white and soft. It had become like the face of a frail old woman. And it was as if this transformation gave a glimpse of the ambiguity in the personality, perhaps just one of the many ambiguities that had tormented Alan. Especially noticeable to me was the skin of his cheeks. It was very white, and seemed to have become very thin, seemed to flutter above the flesh, as though there was some vacancy between skin and flesh, whenever Alan spoke or closed his mouth too firmly. This thin, delicate skin made me think of the outer petal of a blown rose. It seemed to have something of the texture. It made me think also of the faded black plastic sheeting that covered the old cottage-shaped hayrick on the driveway, plastic sheeting so beaten about by wind and rain that it had not only lost its lustre and snap, but appeared also to have developed within its thinness little blisters and air pockets. The man had changed, and he was in my cottage, sitting in my wing chair, half-reclined, looking small, the upholstered wings above his head, his knees neatly together. It was a little as if, this was the idea that came to me, the man that one knew had been subjected almost to a moral attack by the unacknowledged personality within, that the man had been pulled down by this inner personality, which now sat like a watchful guardian on the man's shoulder, and was the only entity with whom Alan could now have a true dialogue. Of the old personality there remained only the clothes that made the upholstery of the chair look grimy. These clothes were as carefully chosen as ever, but the man within was so quiet, so little ebullient, his movements were so slow and considered, that the clothes did not suggest the old personality. From the Phillipses I later heard about the drunken telephone calls Alan had made to the manor at about the time, or perhaps a little before, he had telephoned me. The first three or four had been taken. But then, perhaps Alan had pushed his luck too far, had begun to make the telephone calls at odd hours, perhaps had said things he hadn't said to me. My landlord had become alarmed. Alan's disturbance, so manifest, had given my landlord fresh glimpses of his own acedia again, his own hell. To fear that kind of illness was, in effect, to start being ill again. And for a while my landlord had had a relapse. Alan's telephone calls had been refused. Mr. Phillips had ordered Alan not to telephone again. Alan had been forbidden to come to the house. All Mr. Phillips's protective feelings towards his employer, the sick man, were awakened. The prohibition on Alan's visits was lifted only when Mr. Phillips was sure that Alan had stopped drinking. But the man who had reappeared in the manor was ravaged. That old lady's face was the face of a man beyond cure. And though he refused the glass of wine I offered, quite innocently, not knowing at the time his recent history, though he refused, while insisting, with beautiful courtesy, almost as though he were my host, that I should have a glass myself, his apparent cure was, as with some other bad diseases, only a remission, enabling him, perhaps cruelly, perhaps in a spirit of reconciliation, to look at the world he was leaving and to say his goodbyes. He said goodbye. He never came back. I heard him once or twice on the radio, as bumbling as ever. If only he could have lived there, at that pitch, in something like a radio studio atmosphere, something of that artificial social arrangement, instead of having to go home and be alone. And then one day I heard, some days after the event, that he had taken some pills one night after a bout of hard drinking and died. It was a theatrical kind of death. Theatre would not have been far from Alan's mind that evening. It might so easily have gone the other way. Somebody might have telephoned. Or he might have telephoned somebody, gone to a party in brilliant clothes, been witty or flattering or outrageous, would have ridden over the theatrical moment of suicide. But his solitude would almost certainly have brought him there again. The news was kept from my landlord. Mr. Phillips thought it would be bad for him to be told. But somehow my landlord found out. For him it was one person less in his shrinking world. Another person not to be mentioned again. Of Alan's books and notes there was, of course, almost nothing. Out of his love for the life of the mind and the artist's eye and hand, he had flattered very many people, and it was this flattery that was his odd memorial for a week or so. A number of people who wrote about Alan after his death wrote with that part of their personalities that had almost been created by Alan's flattery. Their obituaries were curiously self-regarding, as much as to Alan, who came out in these notices as an eccentric, an anachronism, someone from before the deluge. The words were actually used in one piece. These people paid tribute to themselves for having known and befriended Alan, for having spotted his talent and sensibility, having been singled out by him for his confidences, his confessions of sadness. No one spoke of his flattery. And more than one person, it turned out, had been telephoned by Alan in distress just a few days before he had died. Mr. Phillips, mentioning Alan's death, permitted himself a look of sadness, a twinge of regret. But then, almost immediately, his face clouded with the irritability which I thought of as his usual public expression. This irritability was like Bray's peaked cap. It enabled Mr. Phillips to express many things. He could wear his irritability dead straight, or he could wear it mockingly or self-mockingly. He could use it to express authority, or to be an aggrieved worker, or it could be the irritability of a man protecting his good fortune, not wishing to exult. Now his irritability bridged his human response to the death of Alan and his professional pride as a male nurse and as protector of the manor. He had spotted Alan immediately, he said. He had spotted Alan's depressive nature. He had been right to forbid Alan the house. The drunkenness would simply not have done. Its effect on my landlord would have been calamitous. And then Alan could so easily have done in the manor what he had done at home. Think of the trouble, the confusion, the further effect on my landlord, holding on to the remnants of his own lucidity and health. That was how he, Alan, was remembered at the place which he thought of as his special retreat. I telephone Phillips and have him meet me at the station. That was how, in one mood, Alan thought, or wanted to think of his time and position at the manor. It was half a social idea, half a literary idea, the being met at the station, with all its old-fashioned country house weekend suggestions. The use of the name Phillips without the Mr., though Alan called Mr. Phillips Stanley or Stan. And Mr. Phillips called him Alan. Mr. Phillips's old father said to me, "So your friend Alan died? Nice man. I hardly knew him. I saw him a few times. He was always very pleasant." He, old Mr. Phillips, the small, neat man, had been walking in the grounds with his tall, pronged staff, the sign that he had come to the grounds to walk and not to work. He was carefully dressed in his very pale colours, no pattern in the fabric of his tie, jacket, or shirt. This absence of pattern, together with the broad lapels, collars, and ties of the period, adding to the pallor of the clothes, suggesting chalk below the tints, the way the chalk of the downs modified the colour of young grass or corn, and in dry weather whitened a ploughed field. The old man said, "Whenever I hear of something like this, I think of my cousin. He died when he was 8, in 1911, coronation year." We were standing outside my cottage, below the beeches. The old man slightly lifted his face. He was smiling. His eyes were watering. I knew the expression. The smile wasn't a smile. The tears were not tears. It was just what happened to his face whenever he began to talk about his childhood or early life. But he couldn't tell me about his cousin just then. We were both distracted by a great squawking noise. The noise was made by a flock of rooks circling overhead. Big black beaks, big black flapping wings.